Chauvin murdered Floyd in broad daylight in front of witnesses and it was recorded. This was an egregious case of wanton violence. Unfortunately, the jury agreed. But what is the takeaway? That the criminal legal system has overcome 400 years of systematic, deep-seated racism by holding a single police officer accountable for the kind of racist violence that has become all too routine? That is the wrong conclusion. It is not only ahistorical and short-sighted, but it gives a distorted sense of progress. To let one cop, albeit a racist and violent one, be the scapegoat for a systematic set of problems is to deny the systematic nature of those very problems. Don't Wright's mother was eloquent when she said justice would bring our son home to us and there is never going to be justice for us. She went on to say that there can and should be accountability for her son's murder at the hands of yet another Minnesota police officer. However, she understood that the demand for justice requires something much more. All of that said, two things are important to remember. Cops should certainly not get special exemptions for heinous acts of violence. And secondly, however, locking up one's cop won't bring back American murdered children, neighbors, friends, and loved ones, nor will it prevent future violence. What is necessary is fundamental systematic change. The new Florida anti-protest law puts a formidable obstacle in the path to this kind of systematic change by subverting the movements that have been principal catalysts for change. The law criminalizes protests that obstruct traffic and makes defacing monuments a felony. It also punishes local governments that decline to be heavy-handed in suppressing protests, mandating that local officials will be charged for damages done in such protests. It calls for 6-month mandatory sentencing for any protester who commits assault upon a police officer. Of course, there are many cases where protesters are being beaten and their deflection of blows gets conveniently labeled as assault. The law also uses the language of mob intimidation, which is defined vaguely as 3 or more people acting with intent to force another to take their viewpoints. It is unimaginable how such a law could be freely enforced. Conceivably, a political argument on a street corner could be cause for arrest. If this is not censorship, so what is it? Another particularly disturbing feature of the bill is that it prevents people from being bailed out of jail until their first court appearance, which essentially mandates detention of protesters prior to a conviction for any crime. This is reminiscent of the detention without charge policies that characterize dictatorships around the world and regimes like the former apartheid system in South Africa. As others have pointed out, many of the behaviors stipulated in the law are already in criminal statutes and is therefore redundant, but designed to intimidate and deter activists. It is important that we make sense of these linkages between the Florida law and the skewed framing of the Derek Chauvin trial. The only reason there is a trial in Hennepin County, Minnesota for the heinous murder of George Floyd in broad daylight is because there were loud and persistent protests in the streets of the U.S. Had there not been protests, there would have likely been an accidental death report, no investigation, and no trial. In fact, the initial press release from the police before video surfaced was a complete cover-up. So the Florida law prevents an important mechanism for achieving a modicum of justice, which is the right of the citizens and residents to protest. The challenge to social movements then is to be over courageous and creative in speaking truth to power. No matter what censoring measures those in power attempt to impose in Florida and beyond. As Minneapolis Black Visions collective leader Candace Montgomery insists, the fight for justice is far from over. The light.
Large chocolate reproduction of Picasso's iconic painting of Guernica has gone on display in the Basque country town. A steady stream of residents has visited the artistic work created by 40 Basque chocolatiers. The work of art is expected to stay in Guernica until it tours different Spanish and European cities. The move marks the 84th anniversary of the bombing of Guernica in northern Spain by Nazi Germany. Picasso painted Guernica to portray the suffering of people and animals wrought by violence and chaos. Upon completion, Guernica was put on display at a Paris exposition in 1937. Lebanon has unveiled its first indigenously produced electric car, which is also the first ever car manufactured in the country. The red sports car Quds Rise is named after the Palestinian holy city of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, which remains under Israel's occupation. The car is adorned at the front with a golden logo of the Dome of the Rock, signifying the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. It's the project of Lebanese-born Palestinian businessman Jihad Mohammed.
We have two sources of electricity. There is the state's electricity that are the generators, so we pay to 10 recharging stations, and we are looking for secure places to install them.
The company hopes to start the production of up to 10,000 units of his electric sports car in Lebanon later this year. Jihad Mohammed says his long-term goal is to compete on international markets for hybrid and electric cars, as well as to make sales in Lebanon. In a remote part of Pakistan, two sisters have come up with a unique idea to help children continue their education during pandemic-related school closures: a camel library. The mobile library visits four villages in Pakistan's largest province of Balochistan. Children borrow books and return them the next time the camel visits. The project was founded by a local high school principal and his sister. Rahima Jalal says she started the project because she wanted children around her remote hometown to continue learning despite schools being closed.
When the coronavirus spread, the entire region and all the schools were closed. There was an atmosphere of depression for old and young alike. The region where I live, there is no entertainment for children at all, no place for outings. The only activity is the children going to school and coming back home. After the schools had remained closed for 8 or 9 months due to COVID, we started wondering what we could do for the children. How could we start some sort of activity which would keep children busy and also be of some benefit to them?
Pakistan closed the schools early in 2020 due to the coronavirus pandemic and sent some 50 million school and university students home. The closures put children in Balochistan at particular risk of falling behind, as the province is Pakistan's most impoverished. Even though some schools have reopened, children in this region still have trouble accessing educational resources. NASA's Ingenuity Mars helicopter has successfully completed its third flight on the red planet while moving farther and faster than ever before. It was nothing short of amazing, says the Ingenuity Project's program executive. The drone covered 50 meters of distance, reaching the speed of nearly 2 meters per second. In its latest flight, the helicopter filmed 80 seconds of video, which are to be sent to Earth in the coming days. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration says similar flights are yet to come, with each planned to be of increasing difficulty in order to push ingenuity to its limits. The experiment will end in 1 month in order to let Perseverance return to its main task, searching for signs of past microbial life on Mars.
When spring arrives, nature is lively and in bloom. This generous season brings with it merriment for humans and animals alike, as they can freely enjoy the greenery. A herd of cows in Sweden have gotten their first chance to graze in green open fields after being cooped up in their farms for the whole winter due to the harsh cold. The event was broadcast live so people could enjoy watching these happy animals springing around. Sweden's traditional cow release ceremony attracts thousands of visitors every year.
Barcelona's famous Casa Batlló has been decorated with hundreds of artificial red roses on the occasion of St. George's Day, a Christian celebration also known as the Feast of St. George. For those in Catalonia, the floral decoration of Antoni Gaudí's architectural masterpiece means the arrival of spring. Many locals say that after a year of lockdown amid pandemic, the decoration seems like a recovery for them. Catalans normally celebrate the occasion in large groups outdoors, but this year, COVID-19 has prevented their traditional way of celebrations. However, they say Casa Batlló's roses have sparked a sense of enthusiasm that life is eventually going back to normal in some way.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A Dutch photographer has captured stunning footage of a super yacht passing through narrow canals of the Netherlands. Tom van Usanen used a drone to record the transportation of the gigantic vessel from its initial facility to the North Sea. The 94 meters long yacht, known as Project 817, is one of the largest vessels to be launched this year. It has been designed to precisely fit the waterways, and even a few centimeters cannot be added to its length or width. The duration of the yacht's transportation also depends on a variety of factors, including winds and the schedule of the bridges. For this super yacht, the mission took 4 days to be completed. Space radar capable of capturing small objects that threaten the safety of astronauts and satellites has been inaugurated at a farm in northwestern Costa Rica. The four large panels that make up the radar are connected to the servers of an aerospace company in San Francisco in the U.S. state of California. The system uses a continuous series of radio frequencies that bounce off materials in orbit and send information back to the servers. An American astronaut present at the ceremony says the radar is most advanced of its kind in the world.
Now this radar, which is the most advanced commercial radar for space tracking in the world, what it does is it sends radio signals into space. As Franklin said, even an object the size of a golf ball traveling at 30,000 kilometers per hour overhead, a tiny amount of those radio waves will bounce off it and can be picked up by these giant reflector dishes behind us.
Costa Rican President Carlos Alvarado also joined by American and domestic astronauts during the event. The radar can monitor objects that transit in low Earth orbit near the equator, an average or an advantage offered by Costa Rica's geographical location.
A museum in London has transformed its gift shop into a mini supermarket selling artist-designed food to help an industry largely affected by the coronavirus pandemic. The Design Museum has reopened its shop with the help of 10 artists. It sells essential products with packaging designed by emerging artists. The market offers goods at the same price of normal markets, both online and at a marketplace. The initiative is led by Camille Walala, who says her project is aimed at supporting the artists reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, the project is to support artists, and I think because obviously at the moment there's no exhibition, people can't really show any of their creative work, and it's nice to have like a feedback when you're creative. It's nice to know, you know, if people like your work. I think this is a really nice platform to just bring artwork on like everyday product, and actually people are going to probably come and just buy them and probably keep them as a piece of art, like, you know, an affordable piece of art from some artist that you like. I think it's a really nice way to display art, so yeah, I think.
Walala says the project also conveys the message that creativity is as important for a living as the other essentials. She says the creative supermarket will also help the museum, which has seen a drop of more than 90% in income because of the pandemic. The shop is open for just 5 days, but artists expect heavy demand. In Hong Kong schools, robots are helping children with autism to live a better life. These robots are part of an educational program called Robot for Autism Behavioral Intervention, or RABI. It's designed for individuals with autism between 3 and 18 years of age and aims to make them more social. The robots engage the children with role-playing and verbal interaction, helping them to resolve issues such as conflicts and bullying. The program was developed by a Hong Kong professor, Catherine So. She says the program will help fight social deprivation of a certain group of people.
We would believe that RABI can help them to, you know, improve their social and behavioral skills, and in turn, enhancing their quality of their life. So to reduce being excluded in the society, and also help them to be included in the future.
Catherine says using robots also helps keep the program structured and predictable, as autistic people are hypersensitive to voices and facial expressions. The program she launched in 2015 has now been adopted in more than 20 nonprofit groups and public schools in the country. More than 1,200 children have used it so far.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A comparison of the number of doses of vaccines manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. We now present you a two-part article written by Prabir Purkayastha, the founding editor of NewsClick.in, a digital media platform. The piece is titled, The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level. More than an eighth of the world's population living in rich countries, the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and the European Union have access to more than 50% of the world's COVID-19 vaccine doses. According to Our World in Data, about 112 million people in the United States alone received at least a single inoculation by 8th of April. This is more than 12 times the total number of people vaccinated in the entire continent of Africa, which has four times the population of the United States. On 8th of April, the World Health Organization WHO said that nearly 13 million of the 31.6 million doses delivered so far to 45 African countries have been administered. And if we do not count the vaccine doses that have been administered in Morocco, truly an outlier in Africa, as of 8th of April, the United States has received almost 35 times the vaccine doses that Africa has. No wonder Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the World Health Organization's Director General, called the distribution of vaccines grotesque and a catastrophic moral failure. Let us not call reserving the bulk of vaccines for a handful of rich ex-colonial or settler colonial states vaccine nationalism. Let us call it what it is. Vaccine apartheid at a global level. How much of the COVID-19 vaccine manufactured in the rich countries has gone to the rest of the world? The answer is that the rich countries have kept their supplies almost entirely to themselves. Moderna's vaccine production has mostly been used to inoculate the population in the United States, besides supplying it to some countries in Europe and also to Canada. Pfizer has supplied its vaccines to the United States from its US facilities, and to Europe and to the United Kingdom from its European plants. It has also supplied vaccines to the occupied Palestine and the Persian Gulf monarchies, and begrudgingly parts of Latin America, but that makes up a small fraction of its total production. The rich countries have had some squabbles with one another over vaccine supplies. An example of this is the clash between the European Union and the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca and the United Kingdom. Perhaps this is why they have had no time to think about the rest of the world. A comparison of the number of doses manufactured by the rich countries with the number of doses used by them in their own countries provides a clear picture of the extent of vaccine apartheid practiced by these countries. An article published in the New York Times in late March reveals residents of wealthy and middle-income countries have received about 90% of the nearly 400 million vaccines delivered so far. Where has the rest of the world gotten its vaccines from? It appears that the only other sources of vaccine for low- and middle-income countries are those being produced by China and India, with Russia providing smaller amounts of vaccines. This is substantiated by various press sources that recount how countries in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa, and Southeast Asia are receiving supplies from China, India, or Russia. How much of the vaccine supplies from Sinovac, a Beijing-based biopharmaceutical company, and Sinopharm, a Chinese state-owned company, was administered locally in China, and how much has been provided to the rest of the world? According to a 5th of April article in Nikkei Asia, which relied on data provided by Air Infinity, an analytics company, about 115 million doses of the vaccine have been used in China, and the same amount has gone to the rest of the world. Similarly, based on the figures released by India's Ministry of External Affairs website on 15th of April, more than 65 million doses of the vaccine produced by the Serum Institute's Covishield vaccine licensed from AstraZeneca have been exported to other countries. With the surge in the rate of infection in India recently, the doses exported from that country have fallen in comparison with the number of vaccine doses it has administered to its own population. According to a 13th of April article in Deutsche Welle, more than 104.5 million people in India have received at least one dose of the inoculation, whilst India has shipped more than 60 million doses of the vaccine to 76 nations. China, India, and Russia are the only three major countries that have been willing to export vaccines whilst also vaccinating their own populations. To curtail the sharp rise of COVID-19 cases in India, the country is currently prioritizing its supplies and has temporarily halted exports of vaccines from India. This has slowed down vaccine supplies to other countries significantly, particularly in March and April, and will impact the COVAX program, particularly in Africa, which is heavily dependent on the World Health Organization's Access to COVID-19 Tools, or ACT Accelerator Program, and its vaccine pillar of COVAX. The Sputnik V, developed by the highly respected Gamaleya National Center of Epidemiology, has shown its efficacy in clinical trials. However, ramping up its production has been slow. Russia's production capacity of vaccines is not on the same scale as Indian and Chinese manufacturers. While many Indian and South Korean companies have expressed interest in manufacturing the Sputnik V, they have yet to start doing so. Only one South Korean company, Hankook Chorus Farm, has started production of Sputnik V, and a large consortium of South Korean companies has signed up to manufacture 500 million doses. Five Indian companies, Hetero Biopharma, Gland Pharma, Stelis Biopharma, Virchow Biotech, and Panacea Biotech, have inked deals with the Russian Direct Investment Fund, or RDIF, for setting up a combined production capacity of 850 million doses. Meanwhile, even as India looks to ramp up its current vaccine production to meet the worldwide demand, it has not been able to do so. Well, dear listeners, that was the first part of an article by Prabir Purkayasla. The piece is titled "The West Practicing Vaccine Apartheid at a Global Level." Tune in tomorrow for the second and concluding part of this article. Until then, goodbye and God bless.
The deadly and highly contagious novel coronavirus has had a huge impact on billions of people's lives, weighing down on the economy, putting workers out of work around the globe, and more. After gaining an understanding of the virus, countries around the world began developing their versions of a COVID-19 vaccine.
It's called Operation Warp Speed. That means big and it means fast. A massive scientific, industrial, and logistical endeavor, unlike anything our country has seen since the Manhattan Project.
The United States, under former President Donald Trump, launched a vaccine program dubbed Operation Warp Speed and invested heavily in producing, delivering, and distributing the jabs. The program proved successful, and the country produced different vaccines for the disease. But under patent-related restrictions, it prevented other nations from having access to the know-how to produce life-saving vaccines at home. With Donald Trump gone, President Joe Biden is now facing increasing pressure to issue a waiver for the restrictions. Several Democratic leaders, including Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, have joined a petition with 2 million signatures demanding that the U.S. administration drop its support of a World Trade Organization agreement that bars other countries from accessing the patents. Charity organization Oxfam has called the current situation of the distribution of jabs in the world as vaccine apartheid, noting that the world is dealing with a public health emergency and that the pandemic isn't a private profit opportunity.
The fact that the U.S. does not want to remove a patent on some of its key vaccine developments against COVID-19 is another symbol of how this empire is ruled by profits, by money, by the pursuit of wealth against everything else. It doesn't care about human life. It doesn't care about human beings and their health and prosperity. It cares about money because the United States worships money. Its God is money. And it's something that's horrible to understand because we're in the middle of overcoming a pandemic that is still very much a threat to a lot of people around the world.
The comments come ahead of shareholder meetings for the giant pharmaceutical company. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, people in the United States have received approximately a quarter of total vaccines administered around the globe. Other wealthier nations in the world have also received significantly higher numbers of vaccines compared to middle and low-income countries. A Washington Post report indicates the United States will have an oversupply of hundreds of millions of coronavirus vaccine doses as soon as July. The figure has raised concerns about possible hoarding in the country. Earlier this month, Amnesty International condemned richer countries for failing a, quote, rudimentary test of global solidarity by hoarding COVID vaccines, accusing them of exploiting the pandemic to undermine human rights. Also, the World Health Organization warned richer countries that their deals with big pharmaceutical companies will hurt the global COVAX program for poorer nations. The UN agency says its plan to roll out 1.3 billion doses of vaccine to low and middle-income nations by the end of this year has been slow, as wealthier nations are approaching vaccine manufacturers that the COVAX program is counting on.
We can't expect these big countries like the United States, like the United Kingdom, to save us, because they haven't, and we're seeing that happen as we speak. We're seeing these first world developed countries hoard access to medicine and vaccines that can potentially save the lives of millions of people around the world. And the only way we're gonna get around this is developing the means of production, developing infrastructure, doing what Iran is doing, what China is doing, what Venezuela and Cuba and Russia and others are doing, and creating pharmaceutical industries that are not dependent on Pfizer, not dependent on Moderna, not dependent on Johnson & Johnson, but are shared technologies by all people around the world.
We're in the middle of a pandemic that has spread to every country in the world. Unless all the Earth's 8 billion inhabitants are vaccinated, the novel coronavirus is expected to stay with us for much longer.
The wholly occupied city of Jerusalem al-Quds has seen regular clashes over the past week between Palestinian residents and Israeli military forces who have been blocking Palestinians from sitting on the steps of Damascus Gate. This is while thousands of Palestinians traditionally sit in the area following nighttime prayers during the holy Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. On Thursday, the Israeli regime forces attacked Palestinians who gathered outside of the Damascus Gate on the north side of the occupied old city of Jerusalem al-Quds. That ignited protests against restrictions on their Palestinians' gatherings in Jerusalem al-Quds' old city during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians were injured at the Damascus Gate of the old city of Jerusalem al-Quds as Palestinian activists confronted hundreds of far-right and extremist Israeli settlers chanting death to Arabs in their rally in the center of the occupied city. Palestinian protesters, angered by chants of death to Arabs from far-right Jewish demonstrators, clashed repeatedly with Israeli police. The Palestine Red Crescent Society said in a statement that at least 105 Palestinians were injured, including 22 people who were hospitalized. Also, Israeli forces arrested at least 50 Palestinians during the clashes. The Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas denounced the violence against Palestinians, saying that he holds the Israeli regime accountable for this serious deterioration. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has denounced Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds, expressing its solidarity with the victims. Meanwhile, dozens of rockets were fired from the Gaza Strip towards Israel in alliance with protesters in al-Quds. Israeli media said that the Palestinian resistance movement fired 36 rockets toward the occupied territories. Israeli authorities claimed that most of the rockets had struck open areas. Only six of the projectiles had been intercepted by the Iron Dome missile defense system. Israel responded by carrying out airstrikes across the besieged coastal sliver.
I think what's going on is that there has been a continuation of violence, state violence, by the Israeli occupation forces against the Palestinians, against the indigenous people. And it is the latest chapter, if you like, of what's actually been going on in terms of that. And this idea of the Zionists trying to take over that land, take over that place, is something that is continuing unabated. And it is something that needs to be recognized for what it is that they are actually doing.
Israel lays claim to the entire Jerusalem al-Quds, but the international community views the city's eastern sector as occupied territory, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state. According to the UN Security Council Resolution 478, other member states are prohibited from establishing diplomatic missions in Jerusalem al-Quds. The resolution states that the Council does not recognize Jerusalem al-Quds as the occupying Israeli regime's capital. Palestinians who seek an independent state in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, with East Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital, have condemned the U.S. pro-Israel agenda. During the former U.S. President Donald Trump, Israel stepped up its settlement expansion in defiance of the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2334. According to the resolution, settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds are illegal. Also, several countries, including the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco, normalized their relations with the Israeli regime by signing the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds. All of them are illegal under international law, for they were built on occupied land.
Unless there is a reality check and unless there is something done to recognize the oppression that the Israelis are carrying out on that occupied land, nothing is going to change. There is going to be no peace without justice being served.
Israel has made it a priority to change the demographics of Jerusalem al-Quds and Judaize the city slowly but surely. While Palestinians are the rightful owners of Jerusalem al-Quds and the international community is against the Israeli regime's illegal settlements, there have not been any moves to stop Israel from advancing its plans.
From drones to missiles, Iran's been enhancing its military and defense capabilities by employing and testing homegrown state-of-the-art technologies. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has recently released footage portraying the country's latest advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage captured by IRGC drones shows close-up shots of an American aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. The Defense Force also released a video that showed its kamikaze drones hitting their targets with surgical accuracy. Meanwhile, the head of the U.S. Central Command, which oversees the American forces stationed in the West Asia region, revealed to the U.S. Congress that Iranian drone power has stripped the American Air Force of what the commander called its upper hand in the world. General McKenzie made the comments in written testimony to the House Armed Services Committee, in which he noted how Washington was daunted by Iran's far and wide application of small and medium-sized drones for surveillance and attacks. The top general said Iran's ballistic missile force is the most formidable in the region.
This is something that is going to be very troubling to U.S. government officials, because they certainly don't want anybody to have major power except for themselves and some of their allies, such as Israel in the Middle East. But as far as the U.S. finally conceding that its power is limited, it's going to take a long time for them to actually recognize that, to face that reality. They're going to work hard to overcome it, spending more money than they already spend on the military. And right now, the U.S. spends more on its military than the next 10 nations combined. So it's going to be another kind of arms race, and it will not have a good outcome at all. But hopefully the United States will at some point turn its attentions elsewhere into some other area, either of the world or looking more closely at its own internal problems.
Iran's military says the capabilities have enabled it to nip any security threat in the bud.
I am announcing today that
tensions between Iran and the United States escalated after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew Washington from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal in 2018 and launched his so-called maximum pressure campaign, reinstating sanctions against Tehran and ramping up its military presence in the West Asia region. What happened following the move has been regarded as a test of strength for Iran, not only economically, but also militarily. One instance proving Iran's military advancements occurred on June 20, 2019, when Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps shot down an intruding United States RQ-4A Global Hawk spying drone with a surface-to-air missile over the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has repeatedly said its military capabilities are merely for the defensive purposes and has called for regional cooperation to ensure peace in the Persian Gulf region. In this regard, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani presented a plan dubbed the Hormuz Peace Initiative, or HOPE, which aims at establishing long-term peace in the region, an issue that Iran says is impossible as long as outsiders are present.
This will happen eventually. More and more nations will see that they can rely on Iran. Iran has the strength, Iran has the will, and Iran is looking for peace in the Middle East. The United States is not looking for peace in the Middle East. It has no interest in peace in the Middle East, which is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons, why the Iranian government will not work with the United States. Iran is a force to be reckoned with, and the United States has just recognized that in a major way.
But what does the U.S. recognition of Iran's military power amid its waning presence in the region mean for Washington? Only time can tell.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it routinely launches airstrikes against targets in Syria. It is also widely blamed for high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran. The regime is believed to have carried out the recent sabotage attack on Iran's Natanz nuclear facility, which operates under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Iran was quick to pledge to retaliate for the attack on Natanz. Tel Aviv apparently knows no limit when it comes to clandestine operations against other countries. The regime always says it carries out such actions out of worries for its own security. Such dangerous policies could be starting to backfire. This week, a sensitive missile factory in central Israel was rocked by a powerful blast. The huge explosion, which created a mushroom cloud, hit the Tomer factory for advanced weapons. Israeli officials say the blast was a test. On Thursday, a missile fired from Syria landed near the secretive Dimona nuclear weapons facility, triggering warning sirens. The Israeli military said the projectile was a surface-to-air missile fired by Syrian forces against Israeli warplanes. It says the projectile overflew its target and landed near Dimona. But the heavily protected nuclear facility is some 300 kilometers south of Damascus. It is a very long distance for an errant missile. The missile fired from Syria on Thursday landed just some 30 kilometers away from the notorious Israeli nuclear facility. Military experts say this has once again revealed that much trumpeted Israeli air defenses are penetrable. The projectile made it through the air defense layers despite the fact that anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems around Dimona have been significantly boosted in anticipation of a possible retaliatory missile or drone attack by Iran or resistance groups close to Iran.
By looking at this particular site, Dimona, where this weapon nearly hit, it's saying, well, if you really want to have some sort of fight, you do realise that your nuclear facilities, we know exactly where they are, and they could be hit too. And I'm afraid just simply repeating the lies about the impenetrability of the Israeli air defences and missile defences is not going to save anybody in a conflict. It's really just hot air.
Israeli media, like the Times of Israel, have highlighted the fact that the missile landed deep inside Israel amid heightened tensions with Iran and after Tehran's pledge of retaliation. Some other media organizations, like the Middle East Monitor, said Netanyahu's comments after the attack on Natanz looked like a claim of responsibility, and this may have pushed Iran to retaliate. Israel seems increasingly worried about the possibility of the United States removing sanctions against Iran to re-enter the 2015 nuclear deal that America abandoned under former President Donald Trump. Israel has always been a vociferous critic of the deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The regime could carry out more covert operations against the Iranians, further raising regional tensions. But if that happens and things spiral out of control, the regime has to be held responsible for possible repercussions for the region and beyond.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. The blessed month of Ramadan has reached its middle. The 15th of Ramadan is the birthday of Imam Hassan, peace upon him, the elder grandson of the Prophet of Islam. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, delivered a long sermon on the last Friday of the month of Sha'ban regarding the blessed month of Ramadan. In part of the sermon, he said, O people, there is a night in this month that is called Night of Qadr. It is better than 1,000 months. The reward of a person who performs a recommended act in this month is that of the one who has performed an obligatory act in other months. And the reward of a person who performs an obligatory act in this month is like that of the one who has performed 70 obligatory acts in other months. One of the raison d'etre of the blessed month of Ramadan is sympathy with the poor and the needy. Fasting causes Muslims to remind the hunger and poverty of the poor. One of the names of Ramadan is Shahrul Mubasat, meaning the month of helping others and sharing them in one's money and belongings. Ayatollah Khamenei says, Mubasat is different from Musawat. Mubasat means accompanying and assisting the faithful brother. It means that one feels as his duty to give intellectual help, financial help, physical help, and reputation help. Dear friends, for sure, helping others becomes more important in the current conditions as many people have lost their job due to the coronavirus pandemic. As it has been said several times, fasting will be nullified if the forbidden act is done intentionally and with free will. So, if a person, for instance, falls in water unintentionally or he is forced to jump into the water and his head is completely covered with water, his fasting will be nullified. If a person doubts that he has done anything that nullifies fasting or not, his fasting is correct and will not be nullified. One of the supplications that are recited in midnight before dawn in Ramadan is Du'a Sahar or dawn supplication. Although there are other supplications for pre-dawn time of Ramadan, but this one is the most famous as it contains rhythmic phrases and mainly focuses on God's glorification and celebration rather than asking anything material or physical from Him. It reads, O God, I ask you for the last degree of your luster while all your luster is lustrous. O God, I ask you for all your luster. O God, I ask you for the last degree of your beauty while all your beauty is beautiful. O God, I ask you for all your beauty. O God, I ask you for the last degree of your grandeur while all your grandeur is grand. O God, I ask you for all your grandeur. O God, I ask you for the last degree of your greatness, while all your greatness is great. O God, I ask you for all your greatness. O God, I ask you for the last degree of your light, while all your light is luminous. O God, I ask you for all your light. O God, I ask you for the vastness of your mercy while all your mercy is vast. O God, I ask you for all your mercy. O God, I ask you for the most complete of your words while all your words are complete. O God, I ask you for all your words. O God, I ask you for the last degree of your perfection while all your perfection is perfect. O God, I ask you for all your perfection. O God, I ask you for the greatest of your names while all your names are great. O God, I ask you for all your names. O God, I ask you for the most dignified of your dignity while all your dignity is dignified. O God, I ask you for all your dignity. O God, I ask you for your most fixed will while all your will is fixed. O God, I ask you for all your will. O God, I ask you for your power whereby you have dominated everything. O God, I ask you for all your power. O God, I ask you for your most authoritative knowledge while all your knowledge is authoritative. O God, I ask you for all your knowledge. O God, I ask you for your oldest favor while all your favor is old. O God, I ask you for all your favor. O God, I ask you for your noblest signs while all your signs are noble. O God, I ask you for all your signs.
Inside Israel.
Subhuman conditions in Israel for foreign workers and migrants. That's according to a report by Israel's Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO. It describes treatment by Israeli authorities of detained migrants akin to torture. Migrants, according to the NGO, are being hit with belts, have lack of contact with the outside world, and receive just moments of free time in the open air in Israel.
14 months you've been in the detention facility in the south of Israel. And 14 months, you make connections, like you said. You are living all day for 14 months with people. And one day, they are seeing you getting out of there. How do they feel about this?
I mean, it is really very sad that being incarcerated there for 14 months. There are a lot of people also for more than that. And there is no any justification at all. They release me without... telling me why, and I'm sure that they gain nothing of incarcerating somebody like me or others who are in Holocaust right now. There is no gain out of it at all, other than torturing some other human beings.
In one location alone, there are 11,465 detainees, including 370 children and 4,969 women. They are living in subhuman conditions that fail to meet legal standards. A new report by an Israeli human rights group paints a picture of humiliating treatment towards foreign workers and migrants. It shows the extent of unlawful arrest and actual physical violence that they face. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies. It revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where migrants are detained. The report states that dozens of detainees were imprisoned for months in several detention facilities all across Israel. In fact, according to the report, authorities in these facilities used extreme methods to control